Xi Jinping may be the most powerful leader of China since Mao Zedong, but it seems one force does frighten him: religious faith. In his 3.5-hour speech at the Congress, Xi said religion needed to become, quote, Chinese-oriented. About 3 to 4 million Chinese worship regularly, according to a new book by China scholar Ian Johnson. He estimates about 70 million are Christian, 20 million Muslim, and the rest a mixture of Taoist, Buddhist, Confucian, and followers of folk religion. They represent a challenge that the communist government is trying to contain, so it downplays the numbers. But in his latest book, The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao, Ian Johnson takes on the propaganda.
Yeah, the word religion in Chinese is a neologism that was coined about 100 years ago. And in the past, religion was not thought of as a separate part of society, something that you did on a certain day. It was part of the fabric of everyday life. And so there wasn't really a word like religion. And so it was coined, taken from the Japanese and imported from the West. So when people hear the word religion in Chinese, that particular word, zongjiao, it has a very politicized, somewhat sensitive connotation. If you say, are you religious, people will often think, do you mean that am I an official in my church? Am I a warden in the church? Or am I a member of the lay Buddhist community? As opposed to, do you just go to church or do you just go to a temple? So you get very low figures of people if you say that word religion. If you say faith or belief, you get much, much higher things. And the key is to ask people what they do. Do you do this once a week or twice a week? Or do you believe that this or that God could have an effect in your life? Then you get very high response rates.
You write in the book, and I think this really sums up a lot of what you are saying, progress is not linear. Churches are demolished, temples are run for tourism, and debates about morality are manipulated for political gain. But the overall direction is clear. Faith and values are returning to the centre of national discussion over how to organise Chinese life. So how are these values now being elevated into the centre of a country that is still officially atheist?
On a couple of levels. On the popular level and in social media and things like that, in daily discussions, people are concerned that their society has no values other than making money. You can see this in these constant debates and hand-wringing over the lack of compassion in society. Just a month ago, a woman was run over at a pedestrian crossing, and nobody stopped to help her because they weren't sure what was going on. She wasn't a friend of theirs. They didn't know who she was. They didn't want to get involved. This attracted a huge amount of discussion. I think it was the equivalent of being retweeted 80,000 times on social media in China. People saying, you know, what's come of our society? What is wrong with us? On that level, you get a lot of discussion, a lot of interest. And then on the political level, the government realizes there is a sense of a moral vacuum, and it's trying to take that high ground and occupy it and determine the parameters of debate and discussion about this. So this is a big part of Xi Jinping's domestic agenda. It's something that doesn't get a lot of attention in the West, but it's trying to create some sort of more moral society.
I mean, wasn't Confucianism the basis of a public morality, though?
Indeed, it was. And I think this is why China, just like traditional societies at least, morality was an important part of daily life. People tried to live a good life according to certain moral precepts. The government is allowing bits of Confucianism to come back in traditional morality. I think they hope to co-opt it, to use it for their own purposes, to solidify their legitimacy. In a way, you might draw a parallel to Russia under Vladimir Putin, who has done an about-face from being a KGB man to supporting traditional values, the Orthodox Church, Russian traditional values, etc., etc.
Yes, and being declared by the Patriarch of Moscow to be a gift from God or something.
Yeah, it's sort of absurd almost. But it's not quite that far. You don't have say, abbots from Buddhist temples anointing Xi Jinping. But the government has, and Xi Jinping specifically, has said very positive things about Buddhism, about Confucianism. He meets Buddhist leaders. He's gone to Confucius's hometown and said very favorable things about Confucian. I think they view those kind of religions, the so-called traditional religions, Buddhism and Taoism and folk religion, more favorably. They're more skeptical about Islam and Christianity because of the perceived foreign ties and this worry that religion could undermine their rule.
Ian, I've been a journalist for over 20 years now, and the story coming out of China for 2.5 decades has been one of prosperity, constant prosperity. The sort of secular orthodoxy is that the wealthier people get, the less religious they become. So why is this inverse in China?
Well, that's right. We had the same discussion in the West. There were people in the 50s and 60s who posited that religion would die out as we got more prosperous and rational and things like that. And there's still a big atheist movement in the West. Similarly, in China, communism is, after all, part of that same modernizing theory. There was this idea, even when religion was allowed again after the Cultural Revolution in the 80s, people in the leadership thought, oh, it'll just die out. It won't last for very long. But I think people need something in their lives that is more than just getting rich. Somebody I talked to said, we thought we were unhappy because we're poor, and now a lot of us aren't poor anymore, but we're still unhappy, and there's something missing in our lives. And, you know, I have to say, not everybody's turning to religion, but a significant number of people are. Maybe because this modernization, this economic growth at all costs has been so brutally pushed through over the past four decades almost, that people are reacting against it and feel a need for just something else in their lives, some sort of values that make life more meaningful.
I wonder though, Ian, if there's also a sort of Chinese version of the prosperity gospel, it's called in, well, certainly North American Protestantism. Is there a prosperity gospel in China that crosses, you know, all of the faiths, Christian, Taoist, Buddhist, that also reinforces the message? I know the provenance of the quote, to get rich is glorious, is highly disputed, but you really can't mistake the sentiment that's been going on there.
No, that's true. All the religions also have, just as you said, with the prosperity gospel in the United States, there's this idea that religion can also help make you more prosperous. And so when you go to temples, say Buddhist temples or Taoist temples, people are often worshiping, hoping to get richer, get wealthier, or that their business deal won't go sour, or that their daughter or son will pass the university entrance test. So there is sometimes a real quid pro quo going on when you hear people worshiping and talking, even, you know, churches as well. You get similar ideas that God will make us prosperous. People often will say, and it's sort of a vulgar understanding of Western history, but they'll say, well, look, the most advanced countries are Protestant or Christian, at least. Therefore, Christianity is not incompatible with modernism, with prosperity, and maybe will even help us get richer.
Yeah. It's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West with you, my guest, one of the world's leading scholars of China, Ian Johnson. Ian's latest book is The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. Ian, your book is full of these wonderful vignettes. Tell me about the celebrity Zen Buddhists who give inspiration to these Chinese real estate moguls.
Yeah, well, this is a very old man who has subsequently passed away, Nan Huaijin, and he is something like, I don't know, people still remember Will and Ariel Durant, who wrote this series, The Story of Western Civilization, and this guy, Master Nan, he has written hundreds of books, all explaining Chinese civilization, explaining the classics, and he's also a Zen master himself, who's been formally recognized as having achieved enlightenment. People went to his retreat in central China, not too far from Shanghai, and would go there for weekend talks with him and have dinner with him and ask him all kinds of advice. And one time, the case you're referring to, I think it was quite telling. this real estate developer had quite a bit of money and was looking for another deal to do. And he asked Master Nan, should I invest in a cure for Alzheimer's? I believe there's a cure for Alzheimer's. And Master Nan, who at that time was something like 95 years old, said, there is no cure for old age. This is a waste of money. And then the man immediately turned around and said, well, what about electric batteries for cars? And Master Nan said, oh, that's good. That's future-oriented. And so the real estate mogul invested in car batteries. And maybe this is why China is, you know, going through a green revolution now, for all I know. But there is this desire to know what's the ethical answer to questions. And this idea that how do I live a proper life now that I've got money? And so for some people, these masters, these traditional faiths and values offer answers.
It seems to me a little bit like the vein of the Christianity that emerged with Norman Vincent Peale, you know, the power of positive thinking, the sort of self-help Christianity. Are we getting that self-help Buddhism, self-help Taoism?
There is a lot of that also. If you go to train stations or especially airports, go to the airport bookshops, so much of it is self-help, answering questions about how to live a proper life. There are these masters who offer lessons on the equivalent of YouTube in China, and they offer retreats. Some people, I know a friend paid the equivalent of $10,000 US dollars, so it was something like 60,000 yuan for a year's membership, and she could go then every weekend if she wanted to fast at this retreat and talk to Buddhist monks about ethical issues and learn to meditate and things like that. So there's a huge hunger, not only among yuppies, but among a wide range of people.
Ian, one of the major characters in your book, a recurring character, is a fascinating man, Wang Yi. He's the pastor of the Early Rain Reformed Church. What does Wang Yi represent about the religious revival in China?
On a broader level, he represents what may be the fastest growing religion in China, which is Protestant Christianity. There were only 1 million Protestants in 1949 when the communists took over. There are now, conservatively, say 50 to 60 million Protestants. It's really, really taken off. And I think here, Wang Yi's church in the fairly prosperous city of Chengdu in southwestern China, it's this well-to-do, educated, white-collar population that is also looking for something. Wang Yi is a former human rights lawyer who converted to Christianity not too long ago, in just 2005, but already has a church with several hundred members.
Do these Protestant churches in China, the type of which Wang Yi leads, do they take anything at all, Ian, from the Western, and specifically the American model of the evangelical megachurch?
Somewhat. They are influenced by the West because some people, not Wang Yi himself, but some other people like him, say, if you think of this as a broader class, have been to the United States to study in seminaries. There's a lot of information that's downloaded on the internet, put up there by Chinese American Christians, Hong Kong as well, Taiwan. So they're influenced by overseas Christians quite a bit. Also, you can see this in discussions about abortion, for example. Maybe it's even a source of concern for the government, because the government doesn't like these kind of foreign ties.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the Chinese diaspora, because in Australia, you can go to some very big evangelical congregations and Pentecostal congregations, and 30, 40% of the congregation, and we're talking thousands of people, will be Chinese. They'll be young Chinese, they'll be university students. So I'm just wondering if that diaspora is feeding back into the religious revival in China.
No, absolutely. One of the great advantages that Chinese in the diaspora have is that when they come back to China, they can come in, say, on a tourist visa, just like other people, but they may not stick out quite as much when they go into the church. And many people who have a theological education come back to China and hold workshops, Bible study. Wang Yi's church has a seminary, and some foreign Christians come in, but they prefer, if they're ethnically Chinese, because then when they come into the building, the guards below won't notice quite as much as if a Caucasian were coming in. So there's a big advantage there. And of course, the language may also be a factor.
Is the style, Ian, though, what we've become accustomed to seeing, the rock music and the sort of speaking in tongues, that kind of preaching? Or I'm just wondering, maybe it's a little more sedate. Maybe they're not quite there yet.
Well, you know, there's some of that. I think there's actually more of that in the past in rural China. There was this Pentecostal movement in places like Hunan in the countryside where people would have visions, there'd be speaking in tongues. Wang Yi's church is interesting because they're really looking for traditions, and they have declared themselves to be a Reformed Christian church. So they are looking at Geneva and John Calvin for their inspiration. And they have actually thought this through very carefully, why they want to become Reformed Christians. They've thought about the role of the Puritans in the United States, the role of this in the founding even of American democracy. It's fairly intellectualized. There's this loose network of Reformed churches around China. They see it as a maybe a little more, I hate to use the word fundamentalist, but it's a little stricter form of Christianity with clear rules and order about what you can do and what you can't do. And that appeals to Chinese people, I think, on the whole, because there's this feeling that there's a lack of rules in society, that anything goes. And this kind of Christianity is much more appealing. And it was kind of funny because I talked to a German woman in Chengdu who had converted a number of these people about 15 years ago. And she was more of a sort of modern Western Christian who had a little ukulele and played it in the park and taught them all kinds of folk songs and things like that. I thought it was like hippie parents who have children who turn out to be accountants, because all of the people who she... Yeah, all the people she converted ended up being Reformed Christians, you know, singing hymns from the 18th century and 19th century. And she and her husband were flabbergasted that this had happened.
Yeah, well,
but somehow it happened.
Yeah, well, there's a wonderful scene that you set where, you know, part of the Christian revival in China is taking place in this city that you basically say it's relatively remote from Beijing, although you can get around everywhere now on the high-speed trains, but it's the hippie capital of China.
Yeah, no, Chengdu is the big alternative lifestyle capital of China. It's got a big gay community. It's got a big alternative life, alternative education. Rudolf Steiner's ideas, Waldorf education is really big in Chengdu. It's far away from Beijing, so it isn't as uptight as the capital. And I think it's not a coincidence that you also find this religious life also percolating below the surface because it's a little more freewheeling.
Just finally, we've spoken a lot, Ian, about the religious revival in China, but we do need to remember and be frank about the ongoing religious repression. How willing is the sort of nominally communist regime to allow this space for religion?
Well, one of the things that the communists did after communism collapsed in Eastern Europe in 1989-1990 is they studied what had happened there, and they noted the role of the Catholic Church in Poland or the Protestant Church in East Germany, not to mention the Solidarity Trade Union and so on. They decided we do not want civil society to exist in China. Mm. They tolerate many unregistered churches and temples, but by and large, if anything political is going on, or if you try to create a national network that is not under the government's control, the government will crack down hard. If it's just personal piety, that's okay. If it gets anywhere into the social activism sphere, the government is much less comfortable with that. Even on something like environmental protection, religious groups getting involved with that, it's very, very skeptical. So this is where the persecution, the crackdowns primarily occur. It's when the government thinks that religion is becoming too strong of a force.
And they're particularly savage with Islam. I mean, the latest news is that the Uyghur population, which lives sort of well out in Western China by and large, they've been forced to download onto their mobile phones an app which essentially allows the regime to monitor how they're using their mobile phones.
Yeah, I'm afraid the government is following the most counterproductive policy possible in Xinjiang and toward the Uyghurs, who make up about 10 million people in China, so about half, a little bit less than half the Muslim population. Sometimes men with beards that are deemed to be too long, or women wearing headscarves are not even allowed on public buses. People are not allowed to fast. Some Muslim restaurants have been forced to sell alcohol just to show that they're, you know, secularized or something like that, to serve alcohol. I mean, I think this is really creating a problem, and this is not going to go away, and it's going to become an enduring source of unrest in China. And I think really the government will have itself to blame for this because of its heavy-handed policies.
And just very quickly, why is Pope Francis so keen to get the Catholic Church into China in such a big way? Because you point out in the book, the Jesuits were early pioneers of Christianity there, but they obviously didn't plant very deep roots. But the Pope seems rather keen on getting back there.
Well, it's hard to know exactly what the Pope is thinking, but my sense is that you had roughly 3 million Catholics in 1949 versus a million Protestants. The number of Catholics has only followed the population growth of China. It's roughly tripled over the past 70 years. So there hasn't been much growth among the Catholics. Protestantism has taken off. And I think a key reason is that Catholicism has been really hit hard by not having ties with the Vatican. It's very hard to appoint bishops. It's hard to appoint priests. And so it hasn't been able to keep up. And I think there's this hope that if we could normalize relations, get things back on track, that Catholicism could partake in this religious revival, which unfortunately just hasn't really been able to do over the past decades.
Have you ever been able to find the secret cardinal who lives in China, apparently consecrated secretly, and no one knows his identity for obvious reasons?
Maybe I've met him, but he never told me. No, I haven't met that person. I met an underground bishop, but no, I'm not sure about the cardinal, the secret cardinal.
That's your next task. Ian, it's been terrific to speak with you. Ian Johnson is one of the world's leading scholars on China. His latest book is The Souls of China, The Return of Religion After Mao. Ian, thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.